This is a great turnout for the 2008 Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Reads program. Thank you all for being here. I'm Steve Gill. I'm a trustee of Washtenaw Community College, and I'm just here to welcome you. And on behalf of Larry Whitworth, the president of the college, and the board of trustees, we want to say how much we appreciate this program and being involved in it. We're just one of the sponsors. There are many other sponsors, and they're listed here, and I think in the materials that you have. But it's a great pleasure to be involved, of our college being involved in the Reads program. When I was elected to be a trustee of the college, I knew it was a great place of learning, but I didn't realize how involved it is in the community. And this is one of the very special ways that Washtenaw Community College is involved, and we have a lot of pride. The trustees have a lot of pride in that. I've started to read The Eighth Promise, as probably many of you have, and I think if you haven't started to read it, you will find, I think those that have already read it have found, that it's a wonderful story, very interesting, very engaging, and I think you'll enjoy it. So at this point, I'd like to introduce Rachel Cheng, who's the Library Director for Eastern Michigan University's Halley Library, and chair of the 2008 Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Reads program. Rachel?
Good evening. Before introducing our speaker today, I would like to say a few words about the Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Community Reads program. This is the fifth year of joint library-city collaboration on the community read. The theme this year is China and America, Bridging Two Worlds. I would like to take some time to thank some of the organizations and people who have been responsible for this year's read. Members of steering committee, screening committee, selection committee, and outreach committee, please stand and be recognized. Thank you. I would also like to thank our sponsoring organizations, Ann Arbor District Library, Ann Arbor News, Community Television Network, Eastern Michigan University, University of Michigan, Washtenaw Community College, and Ypsilanti District Library. As far as process for book selection goes, a theme was selected in May. Screening committee composed of teachers, university faculty, students, booksellers, and librarians scanned through many, many titles for suitability and eventually settled on three books for consideration. A selection committee was then assembled in September and read all three books to arrive at a final recommendation in October. This year's selection is The Eighth Promise by William Poy Lee. A few of us had dinner with Mr. Lee Wednesday night. I asked him at the time if there was anything in particular he would like me to say about him when I introduced him. He looked at me and smiled and said, "You read my book. You know me very well already. You should be able to say whatever you want to say." So he was right, of course. And if you have read his book, you know him already. The rest of you will get to really know him as you finish your book. So instead of trying to do the impossible of introducing him to you, I'm actually going to skip that. At his request, I'm going to take a couple of minutes to talk about why the selection committee chose this book for the Community Read Project. At our meeting, we talked about the fact that if we had only one chance to introduce you to China, which book would give you a better sense of China, not as some exotic country on the other side of the ocean, but a real country with the real people that you can relate to. We like the fact that there are many layers to this book. A lot of committee members commented on the culture of southern China, clan sisterhood, the sense of community, and the values of Toisanese tradition through his mother's voice. As a Chinese who came to this country as an international student, I personally appreciate the Chinese immigration stories and the unveiling of Chinatown. However, it is not just a Chinese story, an American story, or an immigration story. It is a personal story about the relationship between a mother and son. It is a personal story that speaks to our shared humanity. You only have to read the chapter of Ragtag Boy Scouts to see that clearly. So in the words of one of the selection committee members, we chose this book because it's almost as if somebody came up with a theme and then commissioned the book. So, without any further ado, I give you Mr. William Coy Lee. Thank you.
I asked to be separately mic'd, so I didn't have any place to hide. And if you read my book, I think you probably realize I don't have much left to hide anyway. So, first of all, it's a great honor to be here. I'm not a stranger to these parts. I've been to Ann Arbor several times. I actually worked in Detroit in the mid-90s for a marketing company. And Detroit, of course, is a very interesting city. It, unfortunately, in some ways, is endemic of some of the longstanding problems of our country. And sometimes to take a break, I would come to Anne. Hi there. Are you the little ones that have been reading my stories through your mother? Oh, great. I had a chance, just to digress a bit, I had a chance to meet with some teachers the other day, all who had read my book, and I was struck that two of them had read parts of my book to their 10-year-old children, including a very graphic description of a neighborhood candy and cigarette store I used to hang out at. And he says, can you remember things like he did when he was 10? So they were challenged, and I guess they're getting there. But I used to come to Ann Arbor to kind of get this thing that we're used to in the Bay Area, which is, you know, kind of an easygoing multiculturalism where, although people sometimes do retreat to their little comfort zones of culture, there's a wash and people do interact. And so I'm very appreciative of that. When I heard that Ann Arbor had narrowed it down to 3, I went, great, I like that place. And I felt very honored, of course, because the two other people were Ha Jen, who is a very great and accomplished writer, as well as An Chi Min, whose book, Red Azalea, I really love. And I've had opportunity to meet her and to talk to her. And I just said, you know, even if I'm not chosen, this is already great. This is my first book. I just, you know, did it. And to my wonder and amazement and pleasure, I was selected. And so I want to thank you for selecting the Eighth Promise and inviting me to come out here. Thank you very much. How many of you have read or started to read the book? Wow. Okay, great. So we don't really need to do a lot of telling about the book, but there are a few people who hadn't, so let me just to give a brief synopsis. The book is told in two voices, my own and that of my mother, who's here and has come out and is enjoying herself thoroughly. And so it's in alternating chapters, and my mother's story starts in the 30s when she was born and in the Japanese invasion and in the communist nationalist civil war, and finally essentially a political marriage to get away from China to the safety of America. And within a year, I popped out 10 pounds, big baby. And my first nickname was IBB, which is the big baby. So I am sure mom felt that one. And then from there, there's this whole thing about growing up with my mother who speaks Chinese and my father who speaks American, and on his side of the family have been in the States for, well, now we've been over here for 100 years in California. And kind of going through that conflict of assimilation and biculturalism, and then I came of age in the 50s, in the 60s with, you know, those good old rock and roll psychedelic kids of San Francisco and the anti-war movement, State College strike, the Berkeley strikes, you know, lots of exciting things. And then somewhere in the 70s, a really tragic thing happened in our community. All kinds of violence broke out, and my brother got swept up in it, and he essentially got wrongfully prosecuted for a crime he didn't commit, and then we got swept into trying to bring some justice and asking for a new trial. And other kids similarly treated, and we got involved in that. And as we went through that hellish time, I think I was only 21 going to Berkeley and thinking I needed to drop out of school to kind of attend to this. And what happened was that I really realized when I look back what got us through were the quiet ways of my mother from a village 1,000 years old in a farming region called the Pearl River Delta of China, and that there were traditions and ways of being that really kept us together and kept their spirit vital, and I'll talk more about that later. So that's essentially the story. How I started writing, I'm a lawyer, and I've been in business. I worked for Bank of America as an international banker and lawyer from about 79 to 86. I traveled the world, and I found that my bicultural upbringing actually helped me because I was more attuned and sensitive to the way people were thinking and feeling. And I was often sent to handle things that my regular counterparts, usually Caucasian, raised one way, didn't have a clue on how to deal, except to say those guys are crooks. And I didn't have that attitude. I wanted to find out what was happening, what were they thinking, and then I would try to fashion a solution. So that was kind of what I was doing. I later went into practice on my own for 2 years. I was essentially a consumer lawyer defending people who I felt were mistreated by big corporations and doing quite well, except for one thing. I didn't like litigation. I thought it was a nasty, nasty game, and I wasn't suited for it. And I felt that ethically it was starting to erode me, and I couldn't do it anymore. I later came to see that as I was writing this book that probably the reason I couldn't was because of what my mother had imparted to me. And it's very interesting that in the book I examine, you know, there's this expression we have, who's your daddy, right? It's like, you know, who's influencing you the most? And the question I had to really ask, well, who's my mommy? You know, how did she influence me? And well, somewhere in the mid-90s, I had done a lot of things, been part of a advertising company that I became co-principal in, and pretty living a pretty lavish life. And then I felt that, well, this was good, but something else was calling me, and I needed to do something else. And so in about a five-year period, I examined different things, like there was the California Alliance of Family Farmers, where I thought I could use my business skills to connect organic farmers with city centers so there could be a direct feeding of good food and it would be cash flow going to the farmers instead of going to the banks. I looked at different green kind of things to get into more of a values-based lifestyle. But in the midst of that, these stories started coming out of me. I would be doing reports in these part-time jobs in Silicon Valley I was doing to pay the bills. And a story would come out, and it was pretty good. And then I'd be doing another report, and another story would come out. And eventually, I had about 30 of them. And when I spread them out, I saw some narrative themes. And one of them was this idea of biculturalism. One of them was who influenced me more, my dad or my mom. And I talked to some friends, and they said, yeah, explore that. Do this. And then I saw the memoir. I saw the whole narrative arc, and then I outlined it. And then I said, okay, being a good corporate person, I'll give myself 4 quarters to do this book, sell it in another quarter, get it out in another quarter, promote it in another quarter, and then go back to do what I want to do, right? No. What happened was I spent 3 years on the book, full time. I exhausted all my financial resources. And you know what? I don't regret a moment of it. It was the best thing that happened to me, to stop in my tracks, to stop being so busy, and to trust that what was calling me and what was coming was greater than anything I could conceive in my own head. And in the process of that journey, I met wonderful people. I was lucky to have met Alice Walker, who became my mentor and very close friend, and we still are close friends. And she gave me a lot of tips on writing and what writing was about and the place that you write from, to be really clear about your intention and to always write the truth. She said, because if you tell the truth right and you tell it well and you tell it from a place of love, it doesn't hurt. It may hurt you to write it, but it will be good for people to know this. And one of the places she especially encouraged me was when I went through this whole travail of my brother's cause and essentially leaving, losing the legal case. I was devastated, and I suffer what we now call post-traumatic shock syndrome. And she says, and I talked about how I bounced back from that in a sort of a more of a random way, not an intentional way, because we didn't know about those things in the 80s. And she says, you need to really pump this up, because people don't understand that when you take a stand and you go through stuff, there's a cost. And a lot of people just keep going like they've never been depleted or hurt or wounded. And you have to show this. And so, you know, and it's difficult to write about things like that, but I did it. And in time, I met other wonderful people, including Gloria Steinem, who caught wind of the book and read it, loved the Klan sisters and stuff like that. She edited it, line edited it, and I was surprised. I just thought we'd get some feedback from her. And so I still have those edits from Ms. Steinem somewhere in a closet safely secured. But in writing the book, the biggest thing that came to me was I actually was only going to write about myself and my very interesting life growing up in San Francisco. And I was only going to interview my mother for background. But as I started to talk to her, she described a way of life that probably doesn't really exist, of people close to the land, of an independent farming village who only depended upon each other, didn't have government supports, the Klan sisters who would meet and using a speaking system, almost like a talking circle, to work things out, to really listen on every aspect of village life, very strong opinions of how children should be raised, the importance of a mother seeing their child several times a day, even if they're working in the fields or whatever, which is so different from the way we think of how we should be with our children. And also, there was this thing called, which I came to call the chi soups. They were medicinal soups, and they were soups they would make and feed to children to build up their immunity systems. And amazingly, and we had to eat this stuff when we were kids, and we hated it because it didn't taste like Campbell's soup. You know, it's like weird stuff, very, ew, and, you know, cow brain, oxtail, and all kinds of things like that. And then they had this whole regimen of soups for women who were pregnant to keep them strong and the baby strong. And then a postpartum series of soups, the first week of which was to clean out the menses, the second week which was to make this, the milk, mother's milk nutritious for the baby. And this whole time, the woman was kept in a 30-day isolation so that she could heal, her energy body could heal without the winds creeping in. And there were only one or two women in the village who could visit her to keep the infection stuff and the bacteria out. And it was just a really tender way of treating a mother and a baby for 30 whole days that I had never had anyone tell me about. And she laid it all out. And so when I got all this stuff and also some other things about her polyamorous relationship with Bob and my father, and I finally understood who this guy was and why he was around all the time, I went, this is a remarkable story. It's more interesting than me. Mom? You know? So suddenly Mom wasn't a mom. Mom was a complete person. And in this process, we had startlingly became friends. You know, she was still Mom, but she was more than Mom now. And so when I looked for mottos to write this book, I bumped into The Color of Water, which is by James McBride. And for those of you who have read it, it's a great read. He's an African-American whose mother was white Jewish and chose to live in the black community exclusively and turned her back on Jewish-American society. Although, being the good mother she was, she would take the birthright of her black children and benefit from every Jewish charity and school and scholarship. Because as we know, you're Jewish if your mother's Jewish. And so that, and I saw him do this every other chapter in her mother's voice. And I also saw a book called In My Mother's House by Kim Chernin. Kim is best known, I think, for her seminal feminist work, Reinventing Eve. But she also did a book where she interviewed her mother, and I said, that's it, that's what I'm going to do. And so that's how the book came together. So that's what I'd like to do is, since a lot of you have read it, I really would like this to be more of an opportunity for us to have a discussion or questions or dialogue. So I, how are we setting this up? Are there mics? Oh, someone is? Okay, is it in the back or? No, I can't quite see where that is. Okay. Okay, great. So if you want to ask questions, the people go to the mics. And so can someone stand up where the mics are, where each of them are? Okay, that's a mic person there. Great.
There's a mic over here.
And there's a mic over there by the woman in red. So yes, ma'am.
I would like to ask you, do you have any idea of going back to your village and finding out what the modern ideas are there now? Because I saw a documentary about voting in local villages.
Actually, part of the research I did for the book was to go back to the village in the year 2000 with my mother. And what I saw was, the Pearl River Delta is very close to Hong Kong and Guangzhou, formerly known as Canton. And to get there, we took a ferry, took about 3 hours, very lovely country. And the village of Hoisin is the biggest town there, and it's also called Toisan or Taishan in Mandarin. And when I was there first in 83, it was just a little town. It was very sweet and quaint, almost like Oaxaca, the center, or Aix-en-Provence. It was kind of that kind of old town. When I got there in 2000, concentrically, the city had grown about 8 to 10 times its size with a lot of modernization. But they had wisely preserved the old town, so that was still very sweet. So what I saw, there's still a lot of countryside there, there's still a lot of farming. And one of the things I saw one morning very graphically was the older people with their hoes and different farming tools walking off to the fields. And the younger children, the 20s, the teens, in their nice clothes and their lunch boxes, waving goodbye to the elders and going to the factories to make clothes or other items that all of us buy at different stores in America. And I felt a sadness in a way, because I went, who is going to farm in 20 years when the old people are gone? You know, what is the state of food going to be like? So in that particular section, there is a kind of a balance where the growth has not been so big that it's just overwhelmed everything, like in Shenzhen or in Shanghai, which I spent a month in 2 years ago, or the way Beijing has just exploded with modern buildings. So there's options. There's still a very strong farming lifestyle, and I suppose that will go on. Does that kind of answer your question to some extent? Yeah. In our village, there has always been education for women as well as men. And in the book, my mother explains that up to the age of sixth grade, you know, women did go to school full time, or girls. I've always noticed that my mother could read any Chinese paper. And in San Francisco, you know, the Free Press was just jumping. And there's probably about 20 newspapers there in Chinese. And so her literacy and her writing is always something that's very clear to me, and that's a result of the Southern experience. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The reason is that Dr. Sun Yat-sen, who is considered the George Washington of China, was heavily influenced by Thomas Jefferson and other people, and also the Taiping Rebellion, which almost overthrew the last dynasty. And they believed that women were equal and that they should be allowed every opportunity in every area. So there's always been that sort of tradition of equality in the South. So I'm not surprised that our grammar schools, at least there, were educating women. I also found that many of the women who were leaders in the village, and partly because of the clan sisterhood system. So it's very interesting. And what I'm doing in China now is I'm actually spending a lot of time with the post-cultural revolution children, people in their 20s who are just getting out of school, just working, because it's really interesting to me how these people who are not really that heavily influenced by leftist ideology and are involved in what they call the modernization. Every time they say the word modernization, it's like in capital M. And they're very proud of their nation, and they fully recognize and hate the environmental costs of what has gone on in China, and they're all resolved, we're going to fix this. There's this sort of, there's just certainty of purpose that they're going to be able to fix things and all of this. And it's interesting you brought up the voting thing. China is a highly centralized and in many ways we would consider a very repressive regime. But in ways that are maybe the building of future democracy, they are having voting at local levels. The internet has really created a space where people can report and discuss a lot of situations. A lot of the corruption and the unfairness are uncovered by locals and who do a report on the internet, and other people pick it up and they report on it, and then people get pissed off, and then suddenly the newspapers pick it up, and then the central government, kind of like the FBI or internal security, sends people down. So there's a lot of that going on. There are a lot of taboos in what they can or cannot talk about. They cannot criticize the central government. I think there's something called the three T's that you can't talk about, which is Tibet, Taiwan, and another one, I don't remember it, but you know, excuse me? Tiananmen Square, right. In fact, I made a mistake because I was, they're reading this book actually in China. In the American Studies grad level, and I was invited to lecture on it this past December. I gave 3 lectures. And so we were talking about standing up when you know something wrong has happened. How do you do it? And we got into some very juicy questions like, is standing up, when you stand up, is it worth dying for anything that you feel so strongly about? Is it right to take that risk that you could be killed for taking a stand? And, you know, just simple little questions. Won't be on the exam, but maybe on life exam. And so we were talking about this, and I said, well, let's take Tiananmen. You know, those people, when they did that, did they know that they could be killed? And did they do it anyway? Everybody looked at me. I went, oops. The three T's. So then I went, let's take the May 4th movement, the students who protested the Versailles Treaty, the unfair, unequal treaties. Let's do that one as an example. Didn't they know when they marched that the royal troops would come down and shoot them or knife them? You know, did they feel so strongly about the future of the country and what was right that they were willing, you know? And so it was, you know, I had to kind of be careful sometimes in my zeal to be more fully American and kind of saying anything you want to say. So yeah, that's sort of the anecdotal things that I'm picking up of what's happening there. But definitely environmentalism is a very big, big part of the young people's concern. And I, when I was in Shanghai, the people there, because it's kind of like the New York of China, the people there, the young kids are all into business. And I asked a good friend of mine who, I said, so what did you do this afternoon with your girlfriend? Oh, we went and had tea. Oh, well, that's civilized. You talked about stuff. Yeah, what you guys talk about? Oh, MBOs. I said, what in the world is an MBO? I thought it was something, you know, interesting. Management buyouts. So that's what kids in Shanghai talk about on their days off. So I went, oh, okay. So then I go to Beijing, and I meet two young people who take me around, and one of them, a young woman, is involved in environmentalism, and she was very strong that she's going to be part of the people who's going to help clean China up. And she was studying economic green indicators as a way of making corporations aware of the costs of pollution. The other one was coming to DC to study how to manage NGOs better using Western financial accounting tools so that NGOs in China and nonprofits, which is a lot of the way they run their welfare system and everything, can be held accountable and be more efficient. So it was really interesting to me that there were these two strands, one more policy and public orientated, and the other one, which is the business engine of China. Any other questions, or would you mind going to the mic so people can hear? Great. And it's okay for people to kind of line up, right? Oh, great, lovely. And would you mind telling me your name?
Sure, my name's Thomas, and I wanna thank you. I thought your book was very insightful, had a lot of wisdom. And
thank you.
I just have a few questions. One, you had talked a little bit about the civil war between the nationalists and the communists.
Right.
And you called I was just wondering, the nationalists were not much better than the communists as far as being authoritarian. And is it something in the culture you think that there has to be, or there is this authoritarianism in the government?
Yeah, there are a couple of questions here. How were the nationalists regarded as opposed to the communists in terms of an organizing force and a political force in Chinese history? That's the first question which I detect. The second is it better for China to have a centralized authoritarian structure as opposed to the democratic structure that we have here? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I was just thinking, is there something in the culture that somehow it's going to...
Yeah, to be honest with you, I can't answer that question, and I don't know the answer to that question because I'm not a Chinese study scholar, and I certainly haven't studied the history with that view. I think what Iraq has brought up to us is that to build a democracy is more than just having elections. And in order to have a functioning democracy, you have to have a tradition of people respecting the free press, for example, of knowing that it's safe to talk, and of having a kind of a selection election system that essentially coalesces into institutions of free press, respect for law, representative bodies like Congress or the People's Congress, and eventually, hopefully, a president or prime minister and all of that. So I think when you look at democracy that way, Sun Yat-sen, who is a revolutionary that, as I said, took a lot of his inspiration from George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and others, actually advocated the building of a democratic system for China. And I think because China, and this is me speaking as a person and not so much as a scholar, was in such a mess, you know, to begin with, the Qing Dynasty were not really the majority people. They were kind of the Manchurian people who took over, and then they set up an entitlement system where all the victors were just supported by the rest of the people. They didn't, in some ways, didn't always seem to have the best interests of the country as a whole. So it didn't militarize, it didn't take up technology. In response to that, he actually had the three branches of government that were used, so he proposed that. And he also proposed a fourth branch, which is sort of like a civil service exam where people would get jobs by merit, and a branch called the censorship branch. It's not censorship, and you can't say this, but they essentially went after corruption. The people would be fired if they were corrupt officials. So his hope and the nationalists' hope was that this would be the case. And what happened was the Japanese war further just plunged the country into chaos, and it created an opportunity where a very well-organized force along Maoist and Marxist-Stalinist lines was able to essentially come in and take it. Chiang Kai-shek himself was a successor to Sun Yat-sen. I think he had his problems. It's So if you ask me, is it China inherently geared towards authoritarian government? I would say not inherently. If you ask me whether China may be more used to a deeply centralized authority, probably because of the emperor system. But within that system, there's just like our country, there's good presidents, bad presidents, there's good kings, and good queens and bad queens. I think what China is slowly doing now is through the allowance of the internet to also have impact on policy and stories, it's starting to open up, you know, this basic institution of more freer expression. How far it goes, we don't know, but it's definitely not a clampdown. I think the elections they're starting to do on the local level is starting to build up the idea of true representation, you know, and so it's open up, it's out, you know, the box is open. Time will tell whether it will really achieve something we would call free press, free democracy, but it's definitely not saying we can't do this anymore. Does that help you at all?
Yes.
And again, I want to say I'm not an expert. I'm just trying to prompt some thinking here. And actually, one of the best sources to follow this, I read the New York Times online a lot, and they actually do consistently a lot of good articles on what's happening in China. So if you were only to just kind of pick that up occasionally just from the Times without having to be an expert, it would give you a good sense.
Well, I remember that when Madame Chang just died a few years ago.
Yes.
And I read something about that she had a meeting with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Right.
And they were saying she was talking so eloquently about democracy and
yes.
things like you were, you know, the Sun Yat-sen. And
right.
They asked her how she would deal with a union leader, you know, that in America, and she went like this.
Yeah. Well, that was the Chang. They really believed in power, and perhaps in a way that was why a lot of people saw them as corrupt, and it didn't go as well under their stewardship as it was starting to under Sun Yat-sen. You know, and in fact, in an address she gave, she said that we actually would do democracy with a more of a socialist, social democracy like some European countries have. They did not believe in a completely unfettered economic system because they didn't want to have things like the subprime meltdown, for example. They believe in a certain amount of regulation. See, in China, there's something, here's a couple of clues. China is once again resurrecting the profile of Sun Yat-sen as the George Washington, the revolutionary founder of China. So that's a good sign because there's no way he's not about democracy. When they build these centers overseas, they have these Confucian centers now, which they have one in Kansas City, for example, where they're using them to spread Chinese culture and teach language and parts of the United States and the world where perhaps there's not a strong center of Chinese studies. So the fact that they've picked Confucians, which is old and has to do with proper relations and basically the harmonious society, means that now they understand that part of their job is to make sure that society functions for everyone, that's now a goal. So these are good signs. And again, as a spectator, I don't know where it's going to end up, but it's part of what I'm doing for the next few years to kind of watch it.
Well, it certainly isn't Mao's China anymore.
No, it isn't.
Thank God, and thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I have a far less intellectual question.
Okay, and what is your name?
My name is Linda.
Okay,
and
hi,
I know that your mother must be extremely proud of you, but I wonder whether she was comfortable with you writing so openly about your family, and particularly about her with her depression and heartache that she had, along with the joy and the happiness.
Well,
that
thank
she
God
had.
She doesn't read English. That's all I can say. Yeah,
has she read this book? Have you read it to her?
Selectively.
I think you've answered my question.
Yeah. I do want to say that because of the interest of this book in China, they are translating into Chinese. So one day she will get. So I'm willing to take gigs here to get away from San Francisco. I do want to address some of that. In the process, of course, of interviewing my mother for over 30 hours in her original language, I think I earned her trust because, you know, anybody can spend an afternoon talking to their mom saying, I'd like to know about your life. But I would go home and I would look at the materials and organizing, and every time we met, I would have follow-up questions to get deeper. And then other times I said, well, 2 weeks ago you said this, and then last week you said this, and I remember Uncle so-and-so saying this. That doesn't seem to jive. Can you explain to me that? And then she go, oh, I forgot. You're right. Your uncle's right. You know, so there was this whole process of authenticating as much as I could the information she was giving me. Or when I did the cheese soups, I would actually find charts of and the Latin spelling of these things, and that's why they're all in the book. And I said, well, when you said the red berry, do you mean this one or that one? You know, and I'd have them, and she'd have to choose, right? So I did a lot of this stuff, and I think in that process I gained her confidence. And so when we finally got to the subject of this man Bob, this polyamorous relationship they had, you know, we did the usual thing we did. We went and had a nice lunch or dinner somewhere, and then we would drive by the water, by the ocean, or by Marina Green. And there's something about the waves in the water that we both love, and it would just really soothe us. And I put on this innocuous tape recorder from Radio Shack, $29.95, voice activated. Because I didn't, you know, because the thing is, when you interview an older person, you don't want them to fall into performing or being too aware that they're being recorded, because it stiffens people. So we sort of got used to this voice activated thing. I just went, and I fully expected to hear nothing. So tell me about Bob. And just like a nice, clean, crisp, and cold bottle of champagne, she uncorked and she just went, and I didn't have to ask much about that. And I think there's two reasons. One is because I did earn her trust, and two, because maybe she had always wanted to talk about it and didn't think that there was anybody who would ever want to really understand that and accept it as a reality. Okay, so we did that. It's in the book. And it's out there, and we're doing these community events sort of like this, and people are coming up to her and congratulating, you know, her about the book, and, hey, that's really interesting about you and Bob. She go, what? Oh, you know, you and Bob. And they would know all this stuff, and she go, hey, what did you put all this out on the streets for? I didn't tell you you could do that. I went, but it's on tape, you know, he's doing a book, you know, and it's all over America. I can't pull the book back, you know. So there was a little bit of a glitch about that part. I'm still alive, so it wasn't that good. But the nice thing was that when people started to tell her that the level of truth really helps us, that a lot of the women in Chinatown had complicated relationships and they had to deal with it, you know, that and also that this is really a service. Then when she got that, then she really got that this is okay. So that's a good question about that. Your name?
Mary.
Hi, Mary.
I was interested to read in the book that your mother longed for a daughter at one point, because I'd read other books out of China in
yes.
which daughters are not wanted and women are not esteemed.
That's true, yeah.
The idea that women might control something in the village is quite different from the other books that I've read.
Yes.
I myself have two adopted Chinese granddaughters, so mm-hmm. this is very interesting to me.
Yes. I'm not sure what the difference is. We do know that with the One China policy that was, and it's still part of China, in an attempt really to control the population explosion. It's one thing to manage, what do we have, 330 million people, and then four times the size of that in China. So they had this policy, and because of the preference for boys, because of conditioning, all those things that happen in any culture, as we know, a lot of young girls were aborted and the males were allowed to be born. So there was a very pronounced animus, and still is, against that. Why was my mother different? Why was our village different? I think because my mother is who she is. You know, it's the eighth promise. She's about compassion. She doesn't have a lot of judgment about things. And I think because from what she's told me, what I've seen about the clan sisterhood, there's a lot of love and tenderness between the women, and that's a positive thing. you know. So I don't think she has these issues in her mind, or my dad for that matter, about girls. And also, as I said, in the South, the Taiping Rebellion really made women equal. I mean, the realization of it in every aspect of that rebellion's short reign in southern China wasn't fully realized. But, for example, in the royal exams, if you go to Nanjing, which is one of the exam centers before you go to Beijing for the big one, that is a center where there was the only time that a woman scholar won first prize, and it's a woman in Taiping garb. So I think that there's a residue of less prejudice in some places in southern China, perhaps, and because of the Taiping Rebellion, and also because of their village and the educational system, you know. But does that kind of answer it a bit, or
yes,
no?
It helps. Yeah.
Yeah.
I gather then that there are still areas in China where perhaps there isn't that kind of esteem for women, that kind of equality.
I think that it's still a big problem. That's why so many of the children who are adopted are women. You know, families with children from China, is a group that I've been in touch with, and they use the book to kind of teach culture to the Americans who have adopted children from China. I still think that there's a very strong sexism about that in China. On the other hand, what's happening is a lot of the young people who are running things are women. I mean, if you go to a lot of the places, the people who are crunching the numbers, running the place are women. So I think that that's slowly changing. That's not so much seen as sharply that women are necessarily as unwanted or as inferior inferior to men. I'm hopeful that that will change more and more.
Thank you.
Sure. And again, I want to say this is my personal anecdotal observations at this point, and we will see. Yes?
My name is Claire. And,
hi, Claire.
I'm a teacher of Asian Studies at Pioneer High School. I thought you'd be interested in knowing that I've got 100 sophomores who are about to read your book.
Oh, lovely.
But two points came up that I'm very interested in. I'd like to know a little more about the ghettoization, really, of a Chinatown and
sure.
the whole background of Chinatowns.
Sure.
And then also just, I was very interested at the very end of your book, mentioning that Richard was out of jail and had a family,
right.
I believe you mentioned. I'd like to know a little bit more maybe of what happened to Richard and
sure.
how your family really did, once all of that was finished, how that impacted the entire family and the way you look at American justice.
Right. let's see, how much time do we have? can I answer her question first? Or was there something? Excuse me? Okay, well, why don't you add that on and we'll be here till midnight.
No, my name's Edward Yi, and I was curious if there's a story on the other side of the family about your dad, or perhaps the people, the males in the ghettos back when it's practically all male.
Right. Oh, the Bachelor Society? Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I don't know if your dad's alive still.
He actually passed about 2.5 years ago.
Okay.
So, yeah, close to 3 now, I guess, yeah. Okay, let me start with what I can remember, the first multi-tiered question. Very briefly on Richard, when I was writing this book, he said, you know, this is really not something I want to relive. And I don't mind that you need to write what you need to write, but, you know, it's I don't want to be part of the publicity. I'd rather you keep my privacy. But what I can say is he, because of what we did or my mother did in the book, he did fulfill her mantra of encouragement and reminder that life goes on no matter what happens. He is married. He has two precious teenage girls that he loves dearly and spends a lot of time with. He has been working in the finance industry for since he was released in about 85. And he has not one but two minivans and a family dog. He's disgustingly middle class as far as I'm concerned. But considering what he's been through, I think that's a good thing that he didn't turn out broken or bitter. I have to say that, as with a lot of people who have been in prison, that there are still unresolved issues, and I hope that he will sit down and deal with some of that one day. but like a lot of guys, he's not really open to the psychotherapy work. So in terms of the ghettoization of Chinatowns, there's a book out called Driven Out, just came out last year by Gene Felser, who essentially researching newspapers, lawsuits, and other things, documented the ethnic cleansing of Chinese pioneers throughout the West, and eventually the ghettoization into several Chinatowns, San Francisco, LA, Sacramento. Yeah, it happened. It happened from the 1850s to the 1920s. There was a lot of resistance to it, so that was sort of an untold story. And I was very unhappy and angry to read in how many towns throughout the West that this happened in, and in a concerted fashion, you know, of all the injustices of the sheriff, the legal system, just relentlessly doing this. And that is, in fact, why there are Chinatown. Once upon a time, if that had not happened, we would probably be more like Hawaii. And if you've been there, you know, that's a very mixed kind of a culture where a lot of Asians, Japanese Americans, as well as Chinese Americans run the legislature, actually end up being governors and, you know, things like that, and owning the corporation just like everybody else. But that wasn't the history. And as you know, in the book, I show how it created this sort of Jim Crow system, and then having the Chinese six companies run things, and it eventually becoming in their interest to kind of keep us down. And in the 60s, many of us inspired by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and others, we started our own Chinese American civil rights movement. And I think we've done pretty well, actually. You know, we've had a couple of police chiefs, people on the city council, you know, just all kinds of people running things now, and it's been gratifying. It's the way it should be. The gentleman asked about my father and the Bachelor Society. The Bachelor Society is a reference to a time when, because of the kind of racialism, Chinese men were allowed to come as laborers, but women were not allowed to come, because then they would create families, and we would be born here and have rights as citizens, and they'd never go back to China. So it was like a migrant force, just very much like Mexicans are now. And the parallels are stunning in terms of the way the debates are and the issues and the ways to deal with it. It's almost like a repeat, except it's now with Mexicans from you know, the migrant workers. And so that was the Bachelor Society that he's talking about. My dad, as you know, you read the book, went back and married my mother. And that was partly a result there, because there were so few Chinese women in America because of these policies, that quite often they did have to find wives back in the village. Will I do a book about men or my dad? I do have a couple of books in mind that are not on that subject. My one regret is that my dad did pass away before this book could come out for him to read. And my other regret about that is I don't know if I ever would have done a book with more about him or his life, but I certainly would have had liked the time to really talk to him in the way that I did with my mother. You know, it might have been some other kind of work. It might have just been between us. I don't know. But as those of you who know the book, my dad was a conflicted person. There was the good dad and the bad dad, and as we got later in life, I never knew which one would show up. It was I think one of the toughest things in life is to really love someone who's been good to you, and yet they're not thoroughly bad, so you can't just say, I'm never going to see you. And to try to navigate that and do the boundary thing and, you know, try to be with them when you can and know that it's okay to split when it's not happening. So I do have some regrets about that, but I also feel I really tried my best to be with him as he was. So, yes?
Hi, my name is Katima, and I'm from the Lakeshore Apartments.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you thank you. I haven't made it past very many pages in your book, but I am doing, as you stated, and trying to find parallels for my own life.
Uh-huh.
And the statement that you just made is very true. I as well have lost my dad, and I don't have the opportunity to have conversations with him.
Right.
But I still have my mom.
Yes.
And my mom is a block, as most, you know, African-American women are, that were raised in the South, that migrated up North. So the stories for me are very parallel, and I try to find myself as I have started to read your book, because we will as well be having a book club based on the Eighth Promise.
Wonderful.
In our community.
Yes.
But I wanted to know, I care, and I can't open up the dialogue to have conversations with
right.
the women in my family.
Right.
As a culture, we're very strong-minded women.
Yes.
How do you open up the conversation? Like, how did you do that with your mom? Like, and I apologize to those of you in the room, because he may have stated it in the book, but I just haven't made it that far.
I actually didn't really state it in the book how I did it. What was in the book was what I got. I'm assuming that although they're strong and silent, you're close to the women in your family. Or you spend time with them?
We own a business, and
yes.
that's the time that we spend together.
Okay.
And I try to show up so
yeah.
that if they are speaking, I can receive.
Right.
But at the same time, it's you have these questions, and they don't want to go backwards. You
yeah.
know, they don't want to talk about being slaves or indigenous slaves.
Sure.
Or anything
yeah.
of that nature. But for me, I know that they want us to do better.
Yes.
Because they made sacrifices.
Right.
But then for us being women, we want to do better because they're the women, but then they're also
their shame of the
men.
Back, their shame
right.
of
right.
the sharecropping, the
right.
you so country, you still wearing brogans, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And
well, that
you can't break the cycle unless you know the history.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's a tough one. I think that what helped my mom was that she knows I really love her, and that the way I started talking and showed, as I said earlier, a seriousness of purpose, that I didn't take it cavalierly and I came back, and that I had a purpose. There's a book. You know, maybe you might need to find a road. I want to be the family historian, you know, so I just want to talk to you. It's just for us to know each other better, and every once in a while at a family gathering, I'll share it with you. Maybe that's the way to start. Alice Walker wrote in my mother's garden, and she, like me, also looked back at her simple sharecropper mother and all the wonderful things that she did. Wherever she went, they would just take some beat-up old shack and grow flowers and fix it up, and people would come for miles and just admire her flowers and, you know, the knitting and the way that she and her... And she saw herself that were characteristics and appreciation and a love of life that her mother, the sharecropper, the you don't want to go back kind of country person, gave her. Maybe you can start by sharing that story. And did you see what I'm saying? You have to kind of feel it out and let them know you want to do this and it's important. And you know, you might not get everybody. You'll get one and you'll go from there and they'll go. So good luck to you. Yes, ma'am. Do you guys have questions, or is it just the women? We had a couple of guys. Don't be shy. I'm a mother's boy, but I'm a tough mother's boy, so it's okay. Yes, ma'am.
I also have only read the prologue so far of the book.
Yes.
But I'm a farmer, uh-huh. and some friends and I who are in farming and food systems, community food here in Michigan,
right.
Want to create a network of small circles in rural areas and
yes.
urban areas
yes.
where women can come together and support each other in the way that you've described
mm-hmm.
that I just heard for the first time in the clan circles.
Where the clans speaking round and round, yes.
Yes, yes. And so I'm gathering ideas and principles
mm-hmm.
of communication
right.
and motivation, spirit for these groups.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could just comment on some of the principles of the groups that your mom described and how you think
yes.
maybe that could apply to a diverse group of people coming together with a
yeah.
common purpose.
Well, I think at least in the Woo Bay Area, we make fun of it, but a lot of things have developed, like the talking stick in the speaking circle, which I think are very invaluable. And I've seen both men and women use that to great effect. What I would have to say that I've noticed about my mother's speaking round and rounds is, and as I say in the book, there's gossip and Gigi Jaja, which is our onomatopoeic way of saying gossip, jiji-ja-ja, jiji-ja-ja. And then there's, but whenever a problem would come up and people realize it was something they would need to talk about, they would shift into what I call the numinous place. The tone would shift, the energy would shift, and they would all kind of fall into three stages. Like someone would make a problem statement, and then someone would add and refine the problem statement, and then someone would add a fact that they didn't know, and they would. And so there's this kind of a fact-searching process where everyone would just speak, and no one would speak until the person finished. And then from there, at some point, they arrived at an understanding of the problem that everyone agreed to, and then the ideas would come, what would we have to do to fix this problem? What is it that we can't do, have no power over? And they would go through all of that. And then at the end of that, when it was agreed that these were the action steps, then someone, usually an elder person, okay, well, Anne, you do this, and John, you do this, and then we'll get back together and see how that went and go from there. And so those are the three stages that I saw, but I think it was such an implicit part of their culture that they could shift into that space easily. Because of our culture and with all the distractions, what I found worked in talking circles in the Bay Area that I've been in is when people set aside a time where they meet and they're committed to the group and they work together in this way for a while, it's like going to the gym. You build certain muscles and then you have it. You know, something you can run 2 miles without effort. And to use that to build up that way of talking, and then eventually you get to a place where it's more second nature, like what I've seen with my mom. Does that help at all? Or
Was there any method of recording? Or, I mean, I guess it's probably different to have people coming from who don't know each other.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. You have to have a commitment. You know, you're saying that, if I'm hearing you correctly, you have circles. Right? So when you say circles, it sounds to me like you must have 5, 6, or 12 people that you can call a circle, otherwise you're not a group. So you know, if you have that circle and that circle is willing to make a commitment to learn how to work things out in this way, you need the first thing that has to happen, I think, in the American context is you spend time with it. And when you get used to working things out this way without necessarily going to the courts or shouting at each other. Is this making any sense to you?
Yeah, it sounds like defining a problem as a group is an important part of that process.
Yes.
Having some kind of focal point.
Yes.
So you're not just getting together to do jiji-ja-ja, but
right.
But getting together and having a question, and everybody kind of refines it as a group
right.
together.
And that it's not a right-wrong thing in the beginning. It's not who's right, who's wrong, but I understand this is happening. I understand this is... In a way, it's an advertisement called brainstorming. Everybody gets together, and there's no bad idea, and then you sift through it, and then you pick the relevant, the ones that really apply, and build the solution from there.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
It's Hi. Me, Madeline, again.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, I know you're really busy these days, I'm sure, with the book, but I'm wondering, in the book you were talking about how busy you were with some of the social and activist things that you were doing when you were younger.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there's any room or time to do any of that now where you are.
Actually, last year was really busy, and this year I'm kind of slowing down and trying. What is the name of your child?
Tell him your name.
I'm Julian.
Hey, Julian, how are you? I hear you're enjoying my book. Hi. I'm really actually trying to get back to finishing my second book. So that's where I'm getting back to. What has happened to me is I think I've moved away from the more overt political action stuff. And I'm moving more into maybe writing about things like that that will help people to change internally. And then from that kind of moves out to the kind of action you may or may not take. Having said that, I have been and will be a political activist when it's right to do so, but I know that in my life I've shifted into another stage and another way of being. You know, maybe it's just part of the seasons. You know, I'm moving into the autumn of my life, as Jung would put it, and this feels right for me. It came up very critically. There was a group in San Francisco. They offer these retreats in a beautiful place where you can write for 2 weeks a month, and they even have a place in Minnesota if you can spend a month or two riding horses and riding and being fed organic food. So it's wonderful. And I was encouraged by friends of mine to apply to these programs, and I always did, and I said, this is what I'm doing, and I never heard back. And a few weeks ago, they sent me an email and said, we really want you, and someone so-and-so recommended you. And I had visited the website, and I saw the books that they pick, and a lot of them were really wonderful things, you know, but they're very that yang political thing, which is really important. But I said, you know, but I'm not there. I mean, I was there, but the kind of way I'm talking about and the change I'm talking about is different. It's more personal. It's more transformational. And I really wish you would stop wasting my time and building up my hopes unless you have room for that kind of writing. You have room, you know, for that. And I actually had a very good talk with the new coordinator of this, so he said he would talk to people and get back to me. I haven't heard back from him yet, but but he's very nice about it. So does that kind of answer? Okay, great. It's about 8:45. If anybody else has a closing question or two. Yeah, would you mind bringing my mother up? Okay.
Well, thank you all for coming. We hope to see you again next year. But before you go, I have two reminders. Mr. Lee will be signing books in the lobby, and there are books for sale by Borders. And if you are interested, An Chi Min, author of Red Azalea, will be at EMU Student Center on Thursday, February 21st at 7 p.m. for a free author speech. If you read the other books, you may want to come. So thank you again.
I'm right here. Thank you very much. I'll be out there.